Next, we report on the image of poverty.
Being poor is tough enough, but what the public thinks of you when you're poor can make it worse. Listen to a few country songs, and you'll quickly come across lyrics about characters who feel scorned.
50 years ago, President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty, and over those 50 years, television has played a big role in shaping what Americans perceive about those without much money to their names. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has this look at who's poor on TV.
Poor is a relative term in life and on TV. Take breakfast.
Big girls like to eat, honey.
Honey Boo Boo likes to microwave.
A sausage and pancakes mixed together.
For a child in the Baltimore ghetto on the wire, breakfast was a juice box and a bag of chips.
Nah, man, ain't getting no two. Come on, man. You ain't greedy. Take a chip.
In the 1970s, in the Chicago projects on Good Times, it was healthier.
You try some of that oatmeal, and if you make it through the bowl, then I'll try some. Mm.
JJ's sister Thelma made the oatmeal. She was played by Bernadette Stanis.
If you're poor, it goes a long way, and it's pretty cheap.
Temporary layoffs.
Good times.
Easy credit ripples.
Good times.
Even though it was a comedy, Good Times did tackle some of the bad times facing poor communities, like drug addiction and gangs. Esther Rolle played the mother.
Controlling those kids is up to the parents. Now, we wouldn't have any gangs if parents took responsibility for their own kids.
Good Times was one of the highest-rated shows on TV in the mid-1970s, but it was also criticized for giving the impression that being poor isn't so bad as long as there's love. But Bernadette Stanis says that's true.
I, too, was raised in the projects in Brooklyn, in Brownsville, and I lived in a two-bedroom apartment with my mom and dad and five children, so it was seven of us. But we also were very rich in education and in love.
Good Times went on the air in the midst of a recession. Many people were struggling. Norman Lear, who co-produced Good Times, says above all they wanted to make people laugh. But they also wanted storylines that resonated. He says before the 1970s, TV pretty much ignored poor people.
The biggest subjects in television comedy were the roast is ruined and the boss is coming to dinner. Or mom dented the car and how do the kids and mom keep dad from finding out? There were no political problems. There was no poverty. That was the total message, wall to wall, floor to ceiling.
There's a lot of debate about the subject of entertainment TV's depiction of poverty. Do audiences empathize with the poor people they see or look down on them? Take one of the most recognized and reviled of today's reality TV shows. Here comes Honey Boo Boo on TLC.
The Redneck Game is an annual event here in Georgia. It's all about Southern pride, similar to the Olympics, but with a lot of missing teeth and a lot of butt cracks showing.
Overweight, crude, obsessed with child beauty pageants. One critic in the Washington Times called Honey Boo Boo's family stupid, lazy, and hopeless. Another in Salon said it's an example of reality TV's endless carnival of the impoverished on display. But journalist Nona Willis Aronowitz, who covers education for NBC, disagrees with the charges that the family is exploited.
I see them being very playful with each other and being very unapologetic about their circumstances.
I hate reality TV. I can't get a handle on anything that's human.
David Simon thinks reality TV caters to stereotypes. He says he tries to explore the human condition with his TV shows. Simon's HBO credits include Tremé, set in post-Katrina New Orleans, and before that, The Wire, set in Baltimore.
If you walk through the garden, you better watch your back.
David Simon says he wanted to show these characters living in poverty as individuals with distinct personalities, relationships, and dreams. A member of a drug crew, for example, looks after several children in the abandoned row house where they live.
Come on, get up. School day. Y'all gonna be late. Let's go. Get to school. Go. Get up. Come on, man.
We were about the America that got left behind. We were saying something legitimate about that portion of the country that doesn't have a lot of television shows made about it.
The Wire was critically acclaimed. It was used at Harvard in a course on urban inequality. But The Wire was never a ratings winner. David Simon believes most Americans aren't interested in watching TV shows where the main characters are poor.
You know, they want to watch shiny, pretty people You know, there's currencies in television, and the two main currencies are sex and violence, and then the third one is laughs. And to the extent that poor people can suit those currencies, great.
Sex and laughs are the currencies on the CBS sitcom Two Broke Girls. Two beauties, Max, who's been poor her whole life, and Caroline, who's newly poor, now that her Bernie Madoff-type dad is in jail.
The guy who ripped off the entire city is your father. He told us we were having a good year.
Now they're waitresses together at the same Brooklyn diner. In this post-recession world, it rings true, says Nona Willis-Aronowitz.
In previous decades, we might have said one is rich, one is poor, and never the twain shall meet. Now, one is broke and one is poor, and they're in the same job.
The most talked about TV show depicting poverty right now is the gritty comedy drama Shameless on Showtime. Six unruly white siblings on the south side of Chicago are pretty much raising themselves. They party, clip and even steal coupons, scam, and mostly survive. They also have to deal with their deadbeat dad, an alcoholic who's often passed out.
I'm going to call Kev, and he's going to help me find a park bench somewhere far, far away to dump him.
He's dying.
No, he's killing himself. There's a difference.
I can take care of him.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
The Gallaghers are barely scraping by. And like many TV shows about poor people that have come before it, there's humor in the way they cope. Norman Lear says that's fine, so long as the poor characters are the ones making the jokes.
The human condition is sufficiently foolish to find comedy anywhere. People smile through their lives.
Norman Lear should know. He grew up during the Depression. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The more complex our personal technology gets, the more eager television is to take advantage of it. In the case of interactive TV, that now means the ability to vote on contestants and otherwise affect the outcome of what transpires, often in real time. But as our TV critic David Bianculli notes, this new interactive wrinkle actually is as old as television itself. In fact, even older.
And voting couldn't be easier. With a simple swipe, blue for yes or red for no, these performers' dreams are in your hands.
Rising Star, which premiered this summer on ABC, is the latest singing competition series in primetime. It takes advantage of smartphone technology by offering viewers a special app with which they can vote in real time. And it sounds spiffy and new, a high-tech upgrade of the voting methods of shows like The Voice and America's Got Talent, and the granddaddy of them all, American Idol, which relied on interactive phoned-in votes from viewers to declare its first winner a dozen years ago, as announced by then-co-host and now-host Ryan Seacrest.
The winner of American Idol 2002 is... Kelly Clarkson.
But these modern shows that conduct their talent auditions in private or allow judges to cast heavily weighted votes during early rounds aren't really as interactive as they could be or as they once were. The interactive talent show, it turns out, predates TV itself. In 1935, a local New York radio show went national, first on NBC, then on CBS, and offered listeners a chance to both phone in and write to determine the fate of its eager contestants. The program was called the Major Bowes Amateur Hour, and it quickly became one of the most popular radio shows of the 30s and 40s. That first year, in 1935, the show spotlighted four young men, one of whom was a 19-year-old kid named Frank Sinatra.
We have now the Hoboken Four. They call themselves the Singing and Dancing Fools.
Who will speak for the group?
I will. I'm Frank. We're looking for jobs. How about it?
How about it indeed? Before long, Sinatra didn't have to beg to get work. An amateur hour kept finding other talent, including a 10-year-old singer named Beverly Sills. In 1946, Major Bowes died. But his musical director, Ted Mack, transplanted the show's legacy to television in 1947, where Ted Mack's amateur hour became the first genuine hit on that new medium, even before Milton Berle. And TV's Amateur Hour was interactive from the start.
Well, I just wouldn't be fair if I started counting the votes that are coming in. I'll tell you all about it next week. As I say, they've all tried awfully hard. As far as you folks here in the theater are concerned, I want to thank you for encouraging them. You folks out there, well, you know how we feel about the amateurs. We want very much for you to support them with your votes. Let me repeat it once more, because we do have a new telephone number. It's Plaza 74100 here in New York. We have all of the pet milk operators up there waiting for them right now, and they'll be on duty for another half hour.
Another type of early interactive TV, also coming from radio, was Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, a top-rated show that began on CBS Radio in 1946, moved to CBS Television in 1948, the first year CBS TV began operating, and lasted a full 10 years. Tony Bennett and Rosemary Clooney were among the acts that broke out on this show, which measured the applause of the studio audience to crown its weekly winners. Arthur Godfrey, the host, relied on a machine called the clapometer to gauge the response to each contestant.
Okay, thank you. And the violinist, Joseph Bernstein. And Joy Carroll.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know.
And Ingeborg Nordquist, the soprano.
Love is where you find it. Don't be blind. It's all around you, everywhere.
Well, there's no mistake about that one. The audience reaction indicator shows the winner tonight to be Ingeborg Nordquist.
The same clapometer gimmick was used on Queen for a Day, another TV show that made a successful transition from radio in the 40s. The horrible premise of this popular show was that women came on to compete for specific prizes of their choosing. But the winner was the woman whose life was deemed by audience applause vote to be the most pathetic. Here's host Jack Bailey interviewing one typical contestant.
How about children?
I have two.
Good for you. How old are they?
13 and 5.
Well, that's just wonderful. Now, Ms. Burke, I think your wish has something to do with one of the children, or both.
Yes, my boy.
Yeah, what's his name?
John Vernon.
Old John? What's the matter with old John?
Well, he's crippled up with cerebral palsy.
Is that so?
Yes, sir.
And he's now how old? 13?
13.
Yeah, he's had it quite a while. How can we help John?
Well, he needs a wheelchair and he needs a special bike for exercising. Yeah.
Had you promised him this by any chance?
Yes, I had.
Well, why didn't you keep your promises, Ma?
Well, I had to go to the hospital and have my legs operated on, had to quit working.
What were you doing?
Waitress work.
Oh, boy.
25
years, and that did it to your leg.
It sure did, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And now you have to take it a little easier yourself.
Well, I can't work. I'd sure keep my promise.
I bet you would keep your promise. Now, he's a 13-year-old boy, then he wants... Do you want a sort of a special bike?
Well, he needs it for exercising his legs. He's had quite a lot of surgery done. And
yeah. Viva Birch, if you're our queen, we're going to get a wheelchair and a special bike, okay?
Thank you.
She won that week, which means she not only got her wish, but on TV, she was given a crown, a robe, and a royal fanfare.
I crown you Queen Viva! Queen for a day! Queen Viva Birch! Just take your place up there on the throne. Here comes the Duchess with your first gift, the Queen's bouquet of 4 dozen brilliant coronation red roses from our royal florist.
The clapometer was interactive in spirit, but not always in practice, where the dials often were manipulated by a crew member to rig the results. Finally, there was one other example of interactive TV from the early days of television. It was a CBS children's cartoon show from 1953, featuring a live-action host and a high-tech gimmick. The host was Jack Barry. The show was Winky Dink and You. And the gimmick was that young viewers were encouraged to get their parents to send away for a Winky Dink viewing kit, which included erasable crayons, a cloth, and a sheet of plastic to put over your TV set to draw things when you were instructed. In this episode of Dusty Dan Goes to Hollywood, for example, the cartoon character of Dan peeks through a hole in a wooden fence and witnesses a robbery taking place. He seeks help from the TV host, Jack Barry, who in turn seeks help from kids at home with their Winky Dink kits.
I'm giving you exactly 1 minute to turn over the rest of your money. I know you have more than this.
1 minute? Boys and girls, I've got an idea. Dan can't find something to throw over that fence. Whoever has the yellow Winky Dink crayon at home, stand by. You're going to draw right with your Winky Dink kits and draw that rock. Use your yellow Winky Dink crayon. Draw a round circle in Dan's hand. Just a round circle. Make it any size you want. Doesn't matter how well you draw it, as long as you complete it as soon as possible. Only 1 minute and time is flying by. Use your yellow Winky Dink crayon from your Winky Dink kit.
The troubling thing about Winky Dink and you was that whether you drew anything or not, Winky and his friends still went on about their business. And today's interactive TV shows work the same way. Even if you don't cast any votes for American Idol or Rising Star, there will always be a winner, until the show itself is canceled. Which, of course, is the ultimate exercise in interactive television. You can vote by not watching.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Spoon. This is Fresh Air.
If you have a taste for fancy restaurants, you may need a ticket to dine. Reservations are going through something of a revolution. Over the next few months, around 15 of the trendiest restaurants in the world are starting to shift to a ticketing system. Reporter Jeff Tyler begins this story at one of the most exclusive bistros in Los Angeles.
Tuamek is casual.
Bonsoir.
It's tiny, only 28 seats, and it's pricey at around $100 per head. To give you a flavor, on a recent menu, the first course was carrots, hay, cultured coconut milk, white chocolate emulsion, and ramps, a kind of onion. Nothing here is ordinary, and that includes how you pay.
You pay before for your meal, tax, food, and service charge.
Chef Ludovic Lefebvre co-owns Tuamek. If you want to eat here, you have to buy a ticket in advance, and that ain't easy. Every other Friday, tickets are sold online at 8 a.m., and don't be late.
Because it's sold out in 30 seconds, all the time, so fast. In 1 minute, it's sold out for 2 weeks.
The ticket trend started in Chicago at a restaurant called Next, which specializes in theme menus. Currently, it's modern Chinese.
On the center block, you'll find dehydrated glazed beef ribeye chips and wok-seared chili-salted broccoli florets. Beef and broccoli as you've never seen before.
The restaurant's co-owner, Nick Kokonis, was the first restaurateur to sell tickets. And Next even sells season tickets.
Which is a bit like a subscription to a theater group or the opera. It entitles a ticket holder to come to each of our menus. We have three menus a year.
Now, if you're the person paying for the meal, the ticket system can be really inconvenient. Let's consider Tuamek in Los Angeles.
I would say that I've tried to get a table at Tuamek 13 or 14 times, and I've only succeeded maybe four or five.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times.
It reminds me a lot of waking up at 6 in the morning and standing in line for tickets to a Led Zeppelin show or something.
The idea of the ticket makes the experience more like an event, says Chef Lefebvre, with a similar refund policy.
You buy your ticket before. If you don't show up, you lose your money. And Tuamek's the same thing. If you don't come, we keep the money.
He takes that hard line to account for a paradox that bedevils his industry. Even though it's near impossible to reserve a table, once people get the reservation, they often don't show up. To see what I mean, let's drop in on a San Francisco restaurant called Qua. Even though Qua has been named one of the top 50 restaurants in the world, chef and owner Daniel Patterson says,
we have a terrible problem with last-minute cancellations and no-shows. Within a week, we turn over about 30 to 40% of our reservations. So people will make a reservation months in advance and then cancel it 4 days before. The problem is we're a special occasion restaurant, so we don't get a lot of last-minute demand, so those tables will largely go empty.
To fix that, Qua began selling tickets in late July. With the money Patterson saves on no-shows, he's now able to offer discounts for diners who take early or late seatings. Tickets also have some drawbacks. You have to pay for dinner in advance. Older diners may feel at a disadvantage using an internet system, and the tickets can be resold. Back in Los Angeles, I spoke with some guys waiting for their table outside Tuamek. 32-year-old John Bowie bought tickets for the whole group.
I actually thought of selling the tickets. So,
how much would you have tried to sell them for?
I would imagine they go for at least double in L.A.
In some cases, scalpers have tried to sell the hottest restaurant tickets for as much as $2,000 apiece. But the ticket system isn't just for the most exclusive eateries. The idea is spreading to other small businesses, barbershops and nail salons, and even non-emergency medical centers. Any business that has problems with people not showing up for their reservations. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Tyler in Los Angeles.
This is Fresh Air. Friday night on the Cinemax cable network, Clive Owen stars in The Nick, a new medical drama series that stands out for at least two different reasons. The director and one of the executive producers is filmmaker Steven Soderbergh. And the show takes place in the year 1900. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
The first impression of The Nick, the new 10-part drama series that begins this weekend on Cinemax, is that it seems derivative. It's about a maverick doctor who's rude to almost everyone around him, like the abrasive hero of Hugh Laurie's Fox series, House. He works at a hospital in a big city in the shadow of bigger hospitals fighting for attention and respect, like the doctors on St. Elsewhere. The title The Nick, in fact, is short for Knickerbocker Hospital and is as derisive a nickname as St. Elsewhere was for Boston's St. Eligius. But The Nick is set in New York, not Boston. And it's not a modern hospital at all, because this new drama series is set in downtown New York City at the start of the 20th century. And in that way, too, The Nick seems overly familiar, because a recent BBC America series, Copper, covered very similar terrain in both date and place. But here comes a pleasant surprise. Cinemax sent out 7 of the show's 10 episodes for preview. And the more I watched, the more persuaded I became that The Nick was on a very original journey and making the most of its increasingly singular cast of characters. At the center of all this period medicine and mayhem is Clive Owen as Dr. John Thackeray, a medical maverick and pioneer who has more regard for new techniques than any bedside manner. When first we see him, he's shooting drugs between his toes, like Mel Proffitt on Wise Guy, and exhibiting little patience with the staff, like Lucy, a new young nurse from the South played by Eve Hewson. Even though the setting is a turn-of-the-century hospital ward, the verbal tension may as well come straight from the latest episode of Grey's Anatomy.
Which nurse changed the dressings on this man?
Pa did. Per Dr. Gallinger's instructions. Twice in the past 24 hours, and I emptied his drains throughout the night.
And did you recently empty that one?
I didn't. It's tended to have collected very little fluid.
And yet the area where the drain exits the wound is swollen. Perhaps you might have considered clearing the drainage tube of clogs. How long have you been here?
Almost 3 weeks.
Then you should already know, Nurse Elkins, that the goal is to keep the patients alive, not kill them with negligence after a surgeon's done his best to save them. I expect everyone to be well-versed in their responsibilities.
I'm sorry.
No, weakness and self-pity have no place on my ward. If I'm asking too much of you, you can always take the donkey cart back to Kentucky and continue in the fine tradition of curing people with moonshine and angleworm poultices.
These conflicts deepen episode by episode, along with the characters. The head of surgery, played by Matt Frewer from Max Headroom and Orphan Black, demonstrates early on a risky operation that will be tried time and again in subsequent episodes. Each time, it becomes more dramatic and more meaningful. A new doctor at the hospital, played by Andre Holland, is just as gifted, brilliant, and innovative as Dr. Thackeray. But his skin is black, which makes his circumstances and his opportunities completely different. And there are other key characters at the Nick as well. From the heiress who helps fund the hospital, to the unscrupulous ambulance driver who helps hunt for research cadavers and other money-making opportunities. The slowly blossoming beauty of The Nick as a TV series is that it moves in unexpected directions and at a thoughtfully deliberate pace. If you presume Dr. Thackeray is going to bond with that young nurse or the new doctor right away, you'd be wrong. And medical cases which at first appear to be singular events turn out to be continuing storylines, where we watch patients heal or fail to. And doctors, too, keep trying new procedures and new equipment in discovering the path to an enlightened new age of medical science. One impressive aspect of the NIC is that it mixes the latest developments in medicine, a makeshift suction device, a new X-ray machine, alongside more mainstream discoveries like the bicycle and electricity. Soderbergh, who last worked for HBO on the Emmy-winning Behind the Candelabra, trusts both his vision and his actors. The graphic operating room scenes are riveting, even as their primitive and bloody displays of medical technique make you want to look away. And though it wouldn't be fair to sample a clip from one of the later episodes, there's a point midway through the NIC when Clive Owen, in one single passionate scene, provides more than enough ammunition for a shot at next year's Emmy Awards. And Andre Holland, as Dr. Algernon Edwards, is right on his heels. Getting into the NIC, deeply into it, where it begins to prove itself beyond doubt, will take two or three episodes. But once you check into this particular TV hospital and stick around for a while, you'll care about the characters, their stories, and their amazing new inventions.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey.